This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Continued Flyer success. Absolutely incredible couple of games here for the Flyers. And we have a very, very special guest to start us off here on Orange Back Check. Let's start it right now.
This is the Orange and Back Check podcast with Bill Kornfeld and Scott Weinhardt.
All right, this is episode 167 of Orange and Back Check, and we are delighted to welcome an absolute legend in the sport of hockey and one of the winningest American goalies in NHL history, a career spanning 20 years, including right here in Philadelphia, the New York Rangers, Florida, all over, and currently the assistant executive director of hockey operations for United States Hockey, the one and only John Van Riesbroek. John, welcome to the Orange and Back Check show. We are delighted to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we talked about it right at the start, right before we hit record. I mean, this has been a world of success, both men and women's teams under the for the women's under 18 team, winning world's gold medal, 2 years removed from the last time the men's won it in 2021, or excuse me, 3 years. What's your thought process and how that led up to that moment? That kind of success?
Well, I think, you know, we have a good process. We collectively get together with a group of people, and our summer selection camps are really good, both men's and women's. We take a big group, we narrow it down. And then we, you know, the selection process right now in the United States is we're fortunate to have a lot of great players to choose from. So, I mean, I give all the credit to the people in the field that are helping us. We have a great deep bench of coaches. But, you know, we're a grassroots organization, so I don't want to go any further without saying thank you to all the people, whether they're in Philadelphia or wherever they are, getting on the ice with our young players to teach them this great game. I mean, we owe a debt of gratitude, and that's really where our game grows the most.
So what speaks to that success is this is now seven straight years of a podium finish for United States men's hockey. What does that kind of success, as you spoke to, like you're able to do these grassroots, but when you see that sustained success, how does that translate over the next 10 years, 15 years or beyond in your eyes? Like, do you hope to see, obviously, at the Olympics, there's been a gap in the success really since 19. I mean, obviously, you haven't medaled since 1980, unfortunately, but like you see the progress growing. So you're hoping to see something translate, I'm sure. But speak to the future as you continue to see this success at the junior level.
Well, the future's bright. You know, how you win at the most important times is really a credit to our coaching and the way that we've adapted to the game worldwide. We're not just a dump and chase country anymore, and we're not following our friends north of the border and what they do. We're creating different ways to win. And so when we get to a tournament, we have a plan, we have a procedure, we have an identity, but most of all, we have an expectation, and our expectations to win. And that's our job. That's my job, is to make sure that we're focusing on what our identity is, who we are and what we're doing, and the best representation in the United States. And, you know, I mean, I think that everybody in our country has grabbed hold of this game and they love it. They love it live. They love it on TV. They're growing more in tune with it. We're getting players from all over the country. We had four players from the state of Florida. I'm very proud to say that expansion works down there. And, you know, I mean, having four players from that state on a gold medal winning team, I don't think it, back in the mid 80s or 90s when we started there, that anybody would have said this would be the fruit, but it is. And now we can talk about players like Austin Matthews from Arizona and different you know, when they get into the National Hockey League, we're seeing them be the best players in the league.
Yeah. Let me ask you, as far as like how from like your playing days and when you were coming up through through juniors, how much has USA Hockey as a whole improved, you know, coming back from, you know, 20, 30, you know, even 40 years ago?
Yeah. Well, the number one way is our national team development program. Without a doubt, when that was started back in the mid-90s, everybody thought it would bomb. And it's been the greatest piece of success in the history of putting players in the National Hockey League. I believe at this point today, maybe 96 NTDP players are playing in the National Hockey League. When I played and coming through the U.S. system, that didn't exist. And you had to wait a long time to get a college commit. You had to go to some type of junior program. For me, it was major, and that was the only route. Now we have created so many routes. The United States Hockey League is a fantastic league. We're a college-bound country, and it is having a profound impact on the NHL. The best players are coming through college hockey now. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we're, you know, kicking anybody in the shin when we say that. I mean, but we're opening up the gates for more players to have great routes, not only to get an education. There's some great coaches all over the place, but to have all the schools now that we have at D1. And I would, you know, it's a long-winded answer to your question, but those are the reasons that we're having such success.
I know what you mean, and I'm fine with the long winded because I'll be honest with you, I was a USA Hockey coach for a while, as far as like, you know, lower level doing, you know, using the packets, the small area games, and, you know, having that structure that USA Hockey provides is such a profound impact, because you really, instead of just, you know, having old school sheets with drills and running, you have actually a whole platform of, okay, this is the best thing to do to get these kids going and getting into it. And it's a really, really great structure, and it really builds that foundation from that. So, I kudos to USA Hockey and the entire team of yours that you really have a good foundation of know how, where the kids need to start and how they get up to that level eventually.
I'll add one thing to that, and that is on the international front. And that is I played with a player who's now living in Portugal and helping Portugal hockey get off the ground. And he plugs into our CEP training in order to get his levels to be approved. And it's amazing that it's having that international effect, that they can actually plug in at no cost, just get on, get approved, get your level. And then when you go out there on the ice, you just feel like you're so much more prepared. And that's a credit to our ADM coordinators, our Bob Mancini and those who are putting our coaching education together, and it's had a profound impact.
You know, I always look at, you mentioned the international level, and the NHL has really expanded its international reach. A couple years ago, the Flyers themselves, I believe it was Finland, they were out in some of the Scandinavian countries. Like, the NHL's model is just trying to grow. Obviously, the big four sports here, they unfortunately are on the lower tier of it. But as they expand internationally, how does that look to you in terms of what has the NHL done a good job? Do you think they need to do a little bit more outreach? But is it kind of one of those things where they're just dealing with the hand that they're dealt with and making Gary Bettman and company are doing what they can?
Well, I mean, just this year alone, their global series hit, you know, profoundly, I would say, in Sweden. You know, when you grow up in Sweden, because of the offset in time, they aspire to play in the Swedish Hockey League, the SHL. Most people think they watch the NHL, but because of the times, they don't get a lot of chance to watch. They know the NHL, they aspire to the NHL, but they actually watch the SHL. It's the same in Finland. So when we get these great Swedish players and Finnish players that are coming into our league, into the NHL, I should say, I still call it our league, but when they come into the NHL, they are so happy to get this opportunity that they have long, you know, watched. They know Boreas Salming, they know Jari Kurri, they know the legend of the NHL, but when we go and reach them, when our teams go to their land, they get, it's so exciting to see, because we get to do that every year at the World Championships, and we see the fervor for hockey at that level. But when you see the NHL level and the impact it has and the, you know, the pace of the game, it's a surreal crowd. We saw that over in Australia, you know, the Logan Cooley goal and, you know, the impact that that has. And it's a great sacrifice by the NHL to do that. I mean, it's tough to get teams to go there. These are games that matter. And at that time of the year, you know, because it's a long year. So I think that they're really helping everybody out across the board, but not only from just an on-ice product, but an off-ice product. I think that, you know, when you can cross-market the way they're doing, it's brilliant. The NHL is a brilliant organization. They've come a long way. I have nothing but, you know, compliments for how they do things. Everything's first class.
Obviously, as you can tell by Scott's background, my background, we're Philadelphia through and through. And that's why we started this, because we thought that the Flyers podcast, obviously the team was a little bit down when we started back in 2019, 2018. From your perspective, obviously you spent a little bit of time here in Philly over the course of your 20 years. You played against them when you were in on the Rangers, obviously. From a 30,000 foot view, and we'll get into the specifics of your career, but just like from a 30,000 foot view, what does the Flyers look like to you today compared to when you were there? Obviously, I don't anticipate you to have too much of a connection, but maybe you do and can expand on it.
Well, I mean, the NHL is a tough league right now to have success in, especially when you have to manage contracts up against the hard cap. Mm-hmm. So what I say here is not easy peasy. You know, this is difficult, but I think they hired the right coach. They got Torts, and he's doing a fantastic job. He's probably the coach of the year to this point, without a doubt, in my view, because of where he's taken a team and a team that had to rebuild an identity. And that's not an easy thing to do. Everybody thinks, oh, you just have to rebuild your identity. That's a tough thing to do inside a locker room and believe in what you're doing. So I believe that they've been masterful at that. So credit to Torts, his staff. And, you know, I like Jonesy, he's one of the best in the game. So I love his demeanor. I think he's the right person to lead the franchise. I think they needed a piece of personality and they got one. I love the guy. I you know, Danny Briere, I mean, he was in a tough spot, you know, taking over from Fletch and being an assistant. And, you know, it's just a tough spot to be in, but he's handled it well. Yeah, they're going to face some difficulties. They've already faced that, you know, not to get into Cutter in that situation. I mean, you're going to face situations with personnel, with contracts. It's part of the deal, you know, for people to get carried away on it. It's part of the business and you move on. So
agreed.
But I think they're doing a fantastic job. And if I had to pick them today to say this is the biggest turnaround in hockey, it's the best story, it's the biggest turnaround. My affinity for it is I've always respected the Flyers, even when I was in New York. They've been a great organization. Obviously, I knew them under the Ed Snyder days, and they were a family organization. But I think they're the centerpiece. When the Flyers are good, the NHL is good. And that's kind of where I come at it from.
It's funny that, yeah. So actually, a lifetime ago, it feels like now, Scott and I actually worked at the local radio station, 94 WIP. So we've had many interactions with Jonesy at that level, and to like get him to the point where he is now, it's kind of like a surreal situation. Like really like that. And he's so smart. Like immediately as soon as you hired him, and obviously he did the NBC stuff. Like he has his fingers in all 32 NHL teams, but like you met him at the national, at that radio level as we did. And you're like, wow, that's a hilarious turn of events. But it also makes sense because of the circumstances that you know that he can pull off, like the Cutter situation. Obviously, that's not an easy one, and I don't know how in depth that you could go into it. But obviously, that left a sour taste for us here in Philly. And it felt like they were just like...
I don't want to interrupt you there, but I would like to say to you and to everybody, don't take it personal. I know this, it's become personal. Cutter's a wonderful kid. He's just getting started. I mean, I played with Eric. Eric's a wonderful guy. They took it personal with him. Yep. He gave all he had when he was there. And guys are truly wanting to give it all they have. I don't believe it's a factor of he didn't want to be there. There's certain things that are, you know, you can't ever figure out. Sometimes you just can't ever figure them out, and you just have to let them go. They got a great player in Drysdale. There's no doubt. They got a good pick. You move on. It's the way it is. Cutter's going to be a superstar in the game. There's no doubt about it. But there's always free agency. Why? Don't close the door. That's what I say in this business. Don't ever close the door. The guys that have left on sour, you know, he's not the first person that's left Philly that to come back and help them win a championship. Don't ever close a door in professional sports. I mean, because when you do, that means that you're the one closing the door. And I just, you know, sports happen so fast, careers happen so fast, and you need to win championships. You need every piece that you can get. And at some point, this stuff comes around, and you got another opportunity, and you need a player, and that player is going to be available. Don't ever shut a door. But I understand the hard feelings. But I'll just say this, that Flyers are great. They made a decision. Cutter's a great kid. People got to move on.
Agreed. I can't agree with you more. I know that, you know, as a Philly fan myself, you know, you have to kind of, most fans don't have the ability in the city, you know, unfortunately, to take a step back and kind of look at it from a wide angle lens. Like you said, it's a business. So at the same time, like, you know, unfortunately, things like this are going to happen. It's just that, you know, you played here, you played in New York, cities like that, the big cities, they have a lot of pride when things like that happen. When things happen with athletes, a lot of people take it personally when they shouldn't. Yeah. And, you know, they it's a knock against the city when that's not the case, you know. But, you know, it kind of pivoting in on that, and that kind of leads me into a question I have for you a little bit about your career, John, if I may. You're an NHL legend. You know, you're drafted in 1981 by the Rangers, but, you know, went to Sault Ste. Marie, you know, played there for a long time. And then, you know, 1993, you're 30 years old, you know, and you get part of the, you know, Bobby Clark picks you in the expansion draft to go to Florida, a brand new team, brand new market, you know, a place that really didn't know hockey that well, you know, going there beforehand. How were you able to, like, kind of process that and kind of, like, say, okay, I have a new opportunity here, dive in head first, basically as the franchise player?
Well, I think the words that you used, new opportunity, are the greatest words in sports to players. I mean, they're big time. Whenever you get a new opportunity, you know, one name comes to mind right now that's a present name in football is Mayfield, right? Baker Mayfield. New opportunity. All of a sudden, here you are, right? So don't underestimate new opportunity to motivate. For me, I was 30 years old at the time and you know, became that, I would say a cast off, because expansion, that's what you feel like. You know, you feel like you're on the minnow and you're going to the island, right? But the part with that is also you're part of creating an environment that nobody else was there at the ground floor to create. So that's a special environment. So you take that very personal. However, you know, it was Florida. It wasn't like it was, you know, another place that people knew hockey, even though there's a lot of New Yorkers, there's a lot of Philadelphia people down there. So they knew it, but they're always cheering for the other team. So you had to build a solid environment. And then hopefully you can have some success. But I think when I look back, you know, I get asked a lot of questions, especially recently with Florida's success last year, going to the finals and whatnot. And people want to talk about the rat and things like that. But we had some really good character people, Scott Mellenby, former Flyer, and a real strong, you know, character. Brian Scrudlin, kind of in the same mold, real strong character. Tommy Fitzgerald, now the general manager of New Jersey, very strong character. And then you start adding some young pieces. That's how you build. And it's no different today. The you know, the Vegas Golden Knights built, you know, a team that has not been bad at all, but they did it with strong character guys. They added to them. And I think that it's a, you know, like it's everything that Philly's probably looking at today, you know, of how to build a strong team. Obviously, they've made some really good deals. You know, Owen Tippett's turning out to be a fantastic move for them. And, you know, there's pieces that you have to put together, but I mean, you also have to have strong character guys. And I mean, personally, you know, when the Florida piece under Bobby Clark and Bill Torrey, and we had some great leadership, Roger Nielsen, great coach. Those are the things that people identify with and believe in at the end of the day.
And that's that, I'm glad you brought up, you know, like Ed Jovanovski. I, you know, it's funny. And I was actually getting in hockey around in 95, 96, you know, when that, and that whole thing came along and you guys made that run to the final in 96 as a Panther, you know, I'm always been curious, you know, I understand, like, you know, it's just, you know, you get the locker room gels together and everybody gets, you know, everybody gets going and you get momentum and stuff like that. But, you know, you took, you know, that, especially, you know, game four against Colorado, that was a grind of a game, a three overtime game. Tell me, you know, it was the Bruins in five, Flyers in six, you know, Penguins in seven. And then you go to the final. Tell me how, like, that, like, if you could describe that in a couple words about your, like, you know, how would you describe that ride? Like to somebody, like saying, like, you know, if you're looking back now, you know, 25 years later, how would you look back at that and kind of explain that part of your career and that run?
Well, it was unexpected, which is good. I mean, we, you know, people ask about similarities, and when teams get into the playoffs late and they have to make it, that team, we were struggling there at the end of the season, had to win some games to get in. Florida, very similar last year. I think they were the last team to make the playoffs. Mm-hmm. You're desperate. You're playing that desperate way. You know, there's no comfort. Every game's a playoff game. And I think that's what probably helped propel us the most, is that we had that mentality that every game was a playoff game kind of team, because – you know, we weren't going to outscore you. You know, we weren't going to win the 5-4 game as much. We didn't have the firepower of Pittsburgh or Philly. But if we got you in the 2-1 game, watch out, right? Because mm-hmm. we could win that game. And I think that that's, you know, that was the history of that team. And it is the history of most of these teams. You know, you look at Boston right now and some of the teams that have been really good. I mean, they can win the 2-1 game. Philly's winning a lot of low-scoring games now. I mean, right. They got great goaltending with Carter Hart. And, you know, I just think that when you feel like you can win that game, you know, you make believers out of everybody. And when you get into a series, you only have to be one game above 500.
Right.
And right. That's not a tall ask. It's just be in it all the time. And we had everyday guys that wanted to practice every day. They wanted to practice hard every day. These are the types of things that add up over a period of time that really are the glue. The guys that don't want to practice hard every day and they want to take a week off, or you ever notice when a team rests a player, he never gets back to what he was, you know, it's a bad recipe. Even though it's the right decision to rest a star player, they never get back to that streak that they were on, because they're everyday guys, and that's what sports are. You know, to take a couple days off, you get a little itchy, you get, you know, like, you get comfortable. It's not a comfortable game to be in it all the time. And, you know, I know that there's excuses to be made for all teams, and, you know, like, you look at things and how did the room go bad, and, you know, I'm obviously it's resonating this week in Philadelphia and football and all that, but, mm-hmm. you know, nobody's got, you know, the chemistry lab out that can pour in the serum. You know, it's just not that way, because winning is the hardest thing to winning again is remembering what you did last. So
exactly.
It better be habit formed and crusty and edgy. And that's when you kind of put things together. When it's soft and not hard, it's you're never going to win. This team that won the world championship, so I think we only lost two periods. This team didn't want to lose a period. They didn't want to lose a shift. I mean, it was incredible how good this team got in a short period of time. And it adds up to a gold medal. When you get to the end, you're like, oh, wow, we're at the end of this. I don't really want to go home because this is good.
Right.
But, you know, when you get to tournaments, it became edgy for us against Finland. And we had to have, you know, guys that can execute pull us through. And it's in that moment when you're looking to those guys to execute. And when you have the guys that can execute, so when you're talking about a game four, you're in triple overtime, and you have the guys that can execute, you'll win. And I remember back to a five overtime game in Philly. Brian was playing in that, and we had a great team. And that five overtime game, I think we were eating pizza in the locker room in between periods. I was so hungry. I was like, can we end this already? But the thing is that, you know, Keith Primo scores the goal, and it was fantastic. But that was a great hockey team. I actually believe that team was as good as any Stanley Cup winning team ever, and we didn't win. But, boy, did we have a great team. And it's just, you know, you need the breaks. You need to be that edgy. You need to be on the edge all the time. And, you know, that's what makes up expansion teams. And I believe that's kind of what made up my career. I just didn't want to give in ever. Even when I wanted to give in and say, that's enough, you just don't want to ever give in.
Well, that's why you retired and then came back the next year, right?
Exactly.
In 2001, 2002.
I got an opportunity.
Correct. You're right. You know, and I want to kind of just, you know, if you know, I want to ask about your time in Philadelphia. You know, in 1998, when you were a free agent, you know, Mike Richter's available, Curtis Joseph's available, you're available. You know, there's everybody's going for you three. You know, I know Roger Nielsen. You know, he had coached you a couple times. You know, and in New York and in Florida, and he was a big proponent of yours. What was it ultimately that you decided to come into Philadelphia, and why the Flyers over, you know, other opportunities that may have been out there for you?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, I respected Philly big time. I don't even think it was a decision for me to say maybe. It was just yes. And my time in Florida was done. I knew that. I knew I had a lot left in the tank, and, you know, I was applying it. I was in good physical condition, and it was just a matter of getting to a team that could win. I just wanted to play for a team that could win. Philly was the best opportunity at the time, and we had a great team. And, you know, I often think back to our series, believe it or not. I mean, it's probably going to be wild for people to think that I think about this often, but our series with Toronto, because Yannick Perreault's son was on our world championship team, our world junior team.
Yeah.
Gabe Perreault. So I see Yannick a lot, and I'm like, still remembering the backhand goal that he scored in overtime. And I'm like, that was a terrible goal. But the thing is these are the things that stick with you for a long period of time, because we were a better team than Toronto. We shut them out in the first game, you know, made a save because there was a penalty shot in the game, preserved the 2-0 win. Mm-hmm. We go into game two and we were a minute away from our second shutout, and they tied the game late. Then we kind of lost grip on the series a little bit. And like, we actually thought we'd, you know, I was thinking, you know, what did we actually think? We're going to win four straight, you know, but what happens in series, like, I think, you know, when you look back, I had a 9-4-2 in the series, 1.4 goals against.
And which is still at the top of the Flyers.
We lost in six games because of timing of goals. And, you know, I don't look at the 9-4-2 or the 1.4 goals. I look at losing. I will never forget that series, because we were the better team. We couldn't score when we had two in overtime. We had like 10 chances versus their two. And Cujo was good in the OT, but that's just the way things go. But when it goes to being selected by Philly as a great opportunity, it was not even a question of yes or no.
Then let me ask you about the following season, because, like, you know, you guys got off to a little rough start, 0-5-1. You know, that was the season where, you know, Roger had been diagnosed with cancer again. You know, it was Craig Ramsey taking over. You had the Rod Brind'Amour trade, Eric getting the C strip. You know, I know you talked about it a little bit. You know, I remember that team vividly. That what team just, you know, the five overtime game, that team was just, it was an emotional roller coaster that season. And at the same time, you know, towards the end of the season, Brian Boucher starts, you know, taking over more starts for you. You know, you had kind of been in that position before a little bit with Mike Richter splitting time, and then later on, you know, kind of mentoring Rick DiPietro. And, you know, talk about how, like, you know, in a situation like that, how did you like help support Bush in that situation? And, you know, do you believe that, like, it's beneficial for a young goaltender to have a veteran like someone like yourself, you know, giving them that support or pushing them as they need to? If you could talk a little more about that.
Yeah, that, I mean, season starts and, you know, those are, I'd like to say that I remember all of that, but I don't. But I do remember that we got into a groove and we were really good again. So, but, you know, when it comes to the playoffs, who's going to play and all that stuff, you know, I think that Bush got called up, you know, in January, ended up going like some crazy numbers. I don't know what he was, 18-2 or something, had a great run. And then I was in support of Bush. You know, we were competing hard. I played good down the stretch, probably should have started in the playoffs, but there's this theory over there, out in hockey land, of playing a young goalie, like calling him up in this Ken Dryden theory that this is going to go great. I don't personally aspire to that theory because it only happens once and the person's Ken Dryden. You know, I can't, can you name another right. goalie that it happened to? Not too many anyway, but I was all for it because the team was all for it. And I wanted to support Bush, and Bush and I, you know, we had his son Tyler on our team last year. We won a bronze medal, and Bush and I often talk about that. And he's always like, Bees, I said, you know, like I really needed you around me. And it's been always been a good conversation. The thing is that this is what helped us win, because we trounced Buffalo. Mm-hmm. We lost our first two games to Pittsburgh, and they, you know, I thought that they were going to turn to me. And at that point, a behind the scenes conversation is don't change now. You know, it was basically mm-hmm. what I said. Otherwise, you're going to lose a kid. We may win a game, but then, you know, if you lose a game, you're going to be like, who do we play next? It'll be a controversy. And in Philly, everything's a controversy. So that wasn't probably the best way to handle it. And then we won four straight and we were fine. And we had a great series against New Jersey. I actually thought we were going to the Stanley Cup to play Dallas or whoever was in it at that time. But the point was, is that was the right decision for the right time. And, you know, when I look at it, I thought that, yeah, I could just help Bush then the next year and be a part of that. And that's what I wanted to do. And I started to hear, you know, rumblings about this kid from Czechoslovakia that they wanted to sign, this Roman Czechmanic guy and all the rest of it. He would won the world. But the point is that that didn't go down well for Bush and the mentoring process, because there is a lot in the game now. I believe it's switched over to the goalie advisor coach. You know, we had Reggie Lemelin at the time, who was great with us, but mm-hmm. you know, actually the coaching probably came in the mentoring process more than the coaching process at that time. Now it's a lot different. Today is a lot different. There's a lot more video reads. The game's played a lot differently, but for that time, it was, I enjoyed every minute of it. I don't regret any of it. I loved it. Even when I got moved, I totally understood. And Clarkie called me and said, hey, we moved you to the island. The most disappointed person was my wife, because she loved Philly and South Jersey so much that she didn't want to leave.
Yeah. That, you know, and that you know, that's a thing, is like, you know, I remember, John, when you played here and, you know, throughout your career and everything, and, you know, going to the Islanders, you know, you were there and it was kind of the same situation with Rick DiPietro. And then towards the end of that season, you get flipped to the Devils, where you find yourself back in game 7 of the Stanley Cup final again, you know, and then ultimately retire after that ended. Can you talk about your experience, like, you know, having that one last opportunity? What made you retire the first time, and then what made you come back the following year? Because I tell you, it was quite surprising to be like, oh, John Van Beesbrook's back in the league after, you know, like a 5 month, 6 month hiatus.
Well, the easiest way to say this again is, I got an opportunity, but the reason I retired in the first place, when we went to the finals, you know, everybody got exhausted. I thought we were going to win. We were, I think, up 3-1 in the series or something like that. And mm-hmm. I just wanted to win a Stanley Cup, and I probably should have stayed, after I came back and stayed the following year because the Devils won. But mm-hmm. What led to the retirement was just, it was time to move forward, with other things, family things, things that I had on the go. But, you know, my father-in-law started getting sick, and there was a you know, gravity there to get home and be close to him and the family there. So much has been given to me by my wife and that side of the family that I kind of owed it to him. That was really why retired in the first place. And then the Olympics happened, and I went to, you know, I got a call and said, hey, come to the game in the island. I went there, met with Jacques Caron and Lou, and Jacques called me and said, hey, what about coming back? And I was like, really? You know, and then an equipment manufacturer, John Brown, who did my equipment, showed up in my driveway. I'm like, wait a second. This is too convenient. You know, why are you, what are you doing here? And then he's like, well, I just, you know, I've got some new stuff. I just want to show it to you. And then before you know it, I was driving across, you know, cross town traffic all the way back to New Jersey to practice. And the first practice, my gosh, I was so out of shape. And I came home and just went right to bed. But I could still do it. And I knew that I still could do it. My body was in good shape. My reactions were in good shape. And you know, I ended up playing 4 games, won them all or whatever, coming back, and felt pretty good about myself. But I, you know, I always prided myself on being a good guy in the room. At least you try to be, even though when you're getting prepared for games, you know, guys got to know you're ready and had an approach to the game. But, you know, when the locker room's one of the funnest places in the world for the athlete, it's the safest mm-hmm. place. It's the place you can joke the most. It's the place that you have the most fun with a bunch of guys, and I wanted to keep that going. And I still look back on that as some of my favorite times in the sport, or in the locker room with your teammates and getting ready to go and go bash heads.
Yeah. You mentioned John Brown, your equipment guy. And see, the thing is, I'm a goalie myself. So like, I have to ask you, just as a total hockey nerd and a total goalie nerd, obviously, I'm pulling out stats from 99, 2000 straight from my head. What John Brown, you were like a staple in using John Brown gear for the longest time. And, you know, that and your mask, the armadillo mask with the straight bar cage. How particular are you about your gear, and why did you stick with those for so long, despite the fact that, you know, there were different innovations, like, you know, Vaughn was coming out like the Velocity series, you had Bauer with the Reactor series. You know, and I know that, you know, I believe around the time you were also part of the equipment, the symposiums the NHL was having in the late 90s and stuff like that. You know, obviously probably loyalty is a part of it, but how particular about your gear and what was it that John Brown did for you that made you stick with him for so long?
Well, number one is probably consistency. You know, it's a lot different today where guys pull their pads out of the box and wear them. Yeah. The consistency of how, you know, they mold and shape, that used to be a big thing. It took you almost, you know, 3 months to break in a pair of pads. They had to sit right, they had to feel right, and they had to mold right. So that was all what I saw in the custom part of the John Brown relationship that we had. His chest and arm are still probably a staple out there, and those really helped a lot. So I just felt comfortable and consistent, and that's probably it. I mean, when you get into manufacturing anything, if you can be consistent, just think of running shoes, you know. whoever makes the best running shoes is called Nike, right? I mean, so that's just a consistency thing that people want to wear their Jordans, right? I mean, so that's the way it was with pads. It was, and it's hard to match that when you switch over. There's something that feels wrong. As far as that, I needed a helmet that was lighter and felt like, or a mask that felt like a helmet. And the Armadillo did that. It was light. It was Kevlar. And when you got hit in the face, it didn't ping and your ears didn't ring. And people don't know this. I didn't want to have the snaps like they were, like they are today. When the goalie gets hit in the face, the snap snaps off now and the goalie's mask flips over. I wanted to make sure that didn't happen to me. And there's ways of doing it now that it won't happen. I mean, that's a whole separate matter. But when it comes to safety with that helmet piece, I was kind of more of a geek on that. And little thicker padding, things of that nature, that I just wanted to make sure that the head was looked after, because that was a major piece of equipment that it took me a long time to switch from, because first 10 years of my career, I wore helmets. And once you have a comfort and a safety factor, you don't want to change. I mean, I think Dominic Hasek wore that helmet forever and never got on it for that reason. Because, you know, when guys are driving in the net and you're diving all over the place and you're going to get a knee to the head, I mean, that's tough stuff. And today, absolutely, the game's not played that way. The head is not on the ice a lot. There's not a lot of two pad stacking and stuff like that. So,
and you know, because you mentioned the two piece helmet you used to have, you know, that you used to have the cat eye originally, and then you went over to the standard cage. Why did you transition to that? You know, and when it was kind of going the other way, the trend in the league at the time.
Well, I'd like to say that I have all the answers to that. I'd say probably just feel in that. Sight lines, and once you get used to a sight line and it works for you, I mean, I didn't even see the bars after a while, right? So that's the big factor, is most people think, well, all that stuff's in your way. You don't even see it after a while. It's not even an impingement. So that's just basically it, is because, you know, when it's funny, because I'll reference Connor Hellebuyck because of his whole eye thing that he's got going now, which is really cool. Because it's visual, and for goalies, it's vision, right? It's you have to, the goalie that sees the puck the best is usually the best guy in the game. And it's no wonder that he's doing all this eye training and he's the best goalie out there right now, you know, statistically. And we can argue who is and who's not, but, you know, like that kind of training really helps.
Agreed. Okay. Yeah, and that's probably something that you probably worked on throughout your career as well. Like, a lot of the hand-eye coordination, things of that nature behind the scenes and everything. Let me ask you this. Okay, so outside of back in your playing days, and, you know, it won't take up too much more of your time. You had, outside of the big names like Lemieux, Gretzky, Jagr, you know, Bure, players of that era, what's some of the players that used to give you a lot of like trouble, or guys who had like, you know, you had a hard time seeing shots come off the blade, or, you know, guys like, man, that guy's just always a pain to play against. Like, you know, even though, like, you know, he wasn't one of the bigger names in the NHL, so to speak.
Well, I mean, this guy was a big name in the NHL. His name was Alexander McGillney.
Remember
McGillney was one of the fastest darting player, and he can get on top of you so fast that you couldn't get set. And he'd slip one by you. So I would say probably McGillney. The second, and I think probably the guy that's the most unheralded, but he is a superstar in the history of the NHL, is Pat LaFontaine. Pat LaFontaine was one of the best goal scorers and fastest players. And when you can drive the net and do what he did with the puck, like his finesse, the way that he drove, his quickness, and the way he shot the puck, was probably, you know, and I'm talking about guys that I played with against mostly in the East. But if I'm going to rate one guy that was the toughest and probably the biggest snipe that nobody talks about, I mean, he's gotten a lot of recognition over the years, but I would say Timo Solani was probably the most craftiest. He could shoot off his toes. He was probably one of the best goal scorers that, you know, doesn't get talked about, I would say, up there with Jagr and Lemieux and those guys, but I would say Solani is one of the most crafty guys that ever scored. I mean, it's like, it's not like he didn't score a lot. But I mean, having played against the East, you know, you have a tendency to be more, have more of an affinity for the guys that you face the most. So we face the Islanders so much and Washington, and, you know, I probably should pick, you know, a good friend of mine, Mike Gartner, who had a, you know, who could fly. But it's the guys that really got on top of you the fastest. But McGillney, I could never stop. It was a pain in the butt. And another guy that played for Hartford was Jeff Sanderson. Because, again, he got on top of you fast. And, you know, those guys that could do that and really wing it, you know. And then I had a chance to play with Eric and Johnny LeClaire. And just trying to stop those guys in practice was tough enough. But, you know, with Johnny, with his wild wedge and his shot, I mean, he'd get the biggest piece. It would come in. It's all wobbly all the time. There was no, you know, the unpredictability. I believe that if you asked other goalies, they'd probably say LeClaire, because he never hit a, you know, he always hit a rolling puck.
Okay. So kind of like kind of dips and dives. And yeah, I know. Yeah. Even in my beer league, you know, days, I know exactly what you're talking about, because it's kind of like, oh, it's up here. Why is it down there all of a sudden? I understand where you're coming from with that. I know you mentioned one goal that sticks in your mind, the Yannick Perreault one. What's one save that sticks in your mind? It's like, wow, I can't believe I got that one.
Well, gosh, I mean, I don't want to say there were so many, but there were. But the, I mean, we beat Philly in 1986, and they had a beast of a team. And I know that late in the game, when we were playing them in the playoffs, and nobody had us beating them, Brad McCrimmon took a shot from the point and went through traffic, and somehow I gloved it. And I even surprised myself. I'm like, thank goodness, you know, but because it was going in, and they were good at traffic in front of the net, and they had such a big team, and we beat them. I would say probably that. When I watched the tape after, I was like, yeah, that made a difference. And, you know, we didn't do a lot of tape back then, and you'd have to wait, you know, for some highlight, and they never really got the highlight that you wanted to see. So, you know, we'd grab the VHS a week later and be able to watch a game. And I would say that, you know, God rest his soul and beast, you know, but he was such a fantastic player. What a great defenseman. But it was a slap shot from the point through traffic, and somehow I gloved it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, John, I gotta thank you, you know, on a professional level for taking the time out of your day to speak with us. You know, and honestly too, I have to be honest with you. You know, I have to thank you on a personal level too. You know, the reason that your name is on the wall behind me is not a coincidence. So I don't know if you can see it, but
cool. Yeah, I didn't see it until now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's see. Bill was wondering how long it would take you to see that. I was thinking, oh,
I'm shocked it took this long.
Yeah.
So, I saw 34, and I just thinking, oh, there's so many good 34s that, you know.
Yeah.
It's true. But, I appreciate that, Scotty. I mean, this is why we do, that's why we play, is to, like, I'm so proud of our teams now. Like, we started at the top with what I do and putting together teams and watching great players and being able to put them together and just giving, like, I just get such a kick out of seeing our next great players come through. We have so many of them. I know we talked a little about Cutter and people are down on him or whatever, but I get to watch that all the time. And I'm so proud of our country and being able to influence players. My grandkids, they're asking if they can bring the gold medal to, you know, to their teams. And it just has such a great impact when you can impact and influence other people in a positive way. That's why this is the greatest game in the world. Like, we do, hockey is such a great community of people. You know, and it's just a great day, great to be in this business. I owe it so much just to be able to talk to you guys about something I love to do, recall some memories. This is fun. You know, this is what I need to do more of this, actually, because it fills me with joy. Just to be able to do this.
You know, and that's the thing, and that's why I wanted to thank you personally for the impact, because, you know, it, as strange this may sound, you know, I have to be honest with you. I don't think you realize the impact that you had on my life personally. You know, when I was 10 years old, as I mentioned at the beginning, I was watching you shut down Lindros and LeClaire in the 96 playoffs. And then I see your mask, and it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. And I was like, you know what? I want to be a goalie, and I want to be like John Van Beesbrug. And here I am, John. I'm 38 years old, and I have a replica of your Flyers mask, and I have a replica cool and a replica of your Panthers mask in my team colors. There so, you know, and I honestly need to thank you from the bottom of my heart, because you helped me. You helped me develop a lifelong love for the game of hockey. And I don't know if I'd have that if I didn't watch you play. And I'm serious. So I truly appreciate that. And, you know, a while back I heard you say on Chris Nyland's podcast that, you know, you needed the game of hockey more than Nate needed you. And I have to say, I have to disagree with that, because I know how much you inspired me to want to play goal and to still play at almost 40 years old and to have the love for the game that I do. I can't imagine what you've done for other kids and other people out there just by being who you are, playing the game and being a stand-up guy as you've always been. So I truly need to thank you for that, because, you know, it would, you know, it's a huge part of my life. It'll always be a huge part of my life. I'm teaching. I have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, two sons, and I'm teaching them how to skate now. I coached youth hockey for a couple of years, all that just because I love doing the game. And I honestly have you to thank for that. And that's the God's honest truth, which is why your jersey remains on my wall. So thank you, John. Thank you.
That's so cool. Appreciate that.
All right, just an incredible time there with John Van Beesbrug. Hope to have him back on the show. I know, Scott, you're smiling ear to ear. That was one of the coolest guests that we've probably had on this show, and hope to have him back on soon.
That was like a bucket list thing for me. No lie. Like that, you know, it's not every day you get to talk to a player that, you know, that legitimately like got you into the game of hockey. Like that, I'm floored how down to earth and how good like that conversation was. Like, just, you know, it was like shooting the breeze with someone like at a bar or something. It was just really, really cool of him to do that. And, you know, we have to give John a shout out. Thank you to John again for coming on. We have to thank USA Hockey and their PR team, Dave Fisher, to help coordinating all this. This is something that's been in the works for actually a while. And we need to thank all them for making it happen. Simply because it's cool. Like, it's cool to talk and reminisce about that type of stuff. You know, I know not every fan, especially the younger crowd, is going to know who John Van Beesbrug is, but he played in the golden era of Flyers hockey, like the late 90s teams. He was a, you know, opponent there, you know, that golden era of Flyers hockey. He was definitely a big part of, because he was either playing for them or playing against them. So, you know, hopefully our listeners enjoyed that. And yeah, down the line, we hope to get more. You know, we got some things in the works, Bill. We do. We got some things in the works, but so we're trying to get more of appearances on the pod with us. So we got some irons in the fire that we'll share in the future when it's ready.
And we haven't forgotten, this episode, as always, is brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook. We know hockey games move fast, but with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NHL, you can score faster than anything happening on the ice. This week, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. I hope you're taking the Flyers money line on any one of these games coming up, because they are on fire. Why not turn $5 into $200 right then and there? Take the Flyers. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now with promo code THPN. New customers bet just $5 on the NHL and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Only on DraftKings Sportsbook with promo code THPN. The crown is yours. A gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available. For problem gambling, call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/hockey for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gambling resources. NHL and NHL Shield are registered trademarks of the NHL Hockey League. Copyright NHL 2024, all rights reserved. Hey, Scott, I don't know if you know this, and I just talked about it in the DraftKings read. The Flyers are, for a lack of a better phrase, on fire. We talked about how the goalies are some of the best tandem right now in the NHL. I think Torts is hinting at who he's favoring. We'll get into that. All of a sudden, Morgan Frost, after seemingly yelling at Torts going, why am I not playing anymore? And he's now on the ice, is on fire. Owen Tippett has made some of the goals of the years in back-to-back games for the team. This team, now that the Eagles are out, this team has an opportunity to take a stranglehold on the city, and I don't think they are letting that bypass them. I think fans are coming back, and this has just been a lot of fun. So, five-game win streak. Let's see if it keeps going.
Well, listen, Bill, let's put one thing in perspective here. Again, this is still a rebuilding team. Now,
100%.
This is still a rebuilding team. Things are good right now. We told you ebbs and flows. They just got over an ebb. They're in a flow. They're in the peak right now. You know, there's chances are they have a chance to come back down. I'm not trying to knock that. You got to stay realistic with this. I'm still saying they're going to win a round of the playoffs. I still think that, you know, and the way they're playing right now, it's very possible. But I think what's sticking out to me right now is that I look at this and see that. Let me ask you this, Bill. How many times has Sam Ersson allowed four or more goals this season?
This season, I would say no more than twice.
That would be accurate. Okay. And when was the last time he gave up for at least four goals?
I would say probably like November, early December, because that's when he was a little bit shaky and he's kind of settled into a groove here.
October 28th.
Holy shnikes.
Yeah. So it's either been one, two, or three or shutouts for him. And that's the reason I say Ersson is that because this team is just all around playing well, even the goaltending position, they're playing a solid team game right now. And it's fun as hell to watch. Like, look, we haven't seen a creative goal by some, like what Owen Tippett did against Dallas the other night. And God knows how long. I mean, yeah. Not since like
Tort said that himself too. Yeah, Tort said that himself, that he hasn't seen that goal in that kind of goal in a long time.
Yeah, like that's a big deal. Like, you know, the talent is there. So like, that's what we've been saying all along. Not to sound like a broken record, like, we know the talent has been there. This team has the ability to do things. Are they a Stanley Cup contender yet? No, but you're building the foundation of what a team needs to be, and you can only build and get better from here. And that's really, really promising right now that, you know, you generally find out where your team is at around the holidays. Tortorella argues that it's the end of January. Well, we're closing on the end of January, and this team's won five straight.
Yep.
And they're in second place in the Metro. So, like, they have a 60% chance of getting in the playoffs now. That's saying something. On a team that a lot of people said in August should tank. I don't think this team has any reason to tank at all. They have enough young talent on this team where, yeah, it's, you know, they – It's are they exceeding expectations? Slightly. And the reason why I say slightly is because they're grabbing the city by storm, because they don't have the Eagles to grab onto. They don't have the Phillies to grab onto. And I don't even know even how the Sixers are doing, because nobody's really talking about them. So, like, that's the point, is that we haven't gotten into that winter sports scene yet, because the Eagles season just ended in here in Philadelphia. So the point is that you're going to start seeing the Flyers now a little more of the glass of them, but people are looking and say, wow, they've been that good. Well, yeah. Yeah. You've been missing a lot, man. You're missing a lot.
Yeah. And you know what? Not to pour, cause I'm enjoying this season. I think we can continue to enjoy this season as best we can for the last set of games and plus the playoffs. However, I don't know if you saw this. It was on NBC Sports prior to, I think it was the Dallas game. It might've been the game before. Torts did an interview with NBC Sports Network Philly and said anything along the lines of, we're still sticking to the plan. We are going to make moves at this trade deadline that are probably going to annoy some fans. But we are not falling in love with anyone on this team, which Correct. Shocks me, because I think there's some players that are falling in love with, because
they're here for the foreseeable future in their eyes. We'll see what happens. But I get his point. Like, he's right. It is going to be weird because they're having sustained success with this current roster. But you also, you don't want to be a Columbus from, what was it, 2018 or 2019 when you beat Tampa Bay in the first round as a second wild card and you just upset the President's Trophy team. You want to be the Tampa Bay Lightning that we've seen that won back-to-back cups with sustained success. And I think the old adage is, and we've said, I remember even saying it during the Hextall GM era. You don't want to sell today, or I'm sorry, you don't want to sell tomorrow to win today. And thankfully, they're not, it seemingly, they're not going to stick to it, or they're going to stick to that, where they're going to make the right moves to make this, hey, we're going to have this success and have fun with it as long as we possibly can. But we also know that we are severely lacking in certain areas that we need to address, and they're going to do that. So, I'm not looking forward to the trade deadline in, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it is, strictly because I know I'm going to get angry, but I have to, like, you have the fans especially have to stick to the plan of or stay to the focus of what they're trying to achieve for this team, and that's sustained success and a Stanley Cup sustained success in terms of contendership. And I think anyone that is able to watch this team knows they're not Stanley Cup contenders today. And they're not going to be Stanley Cup contenders next year. We're talking about 2 or 3 years from now. And
we've been saying 2 or 3 years for the last
decade.
That's
the thing.
we have been. And look, I mean, you don't know. You don't know. Okay. So this is the argument I will push back on a little bit. What have the Rangers done the last 2 years?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And they're considered Stanley Cup contenders. Why?
No, they just rack up points. They
have more talent on their team. They have Mika Zibanejad. They have Artemi Panarin. They've got solid goaltending. Igor Shesterkin. They have Adam Fox, who stepped up. They have Jacob Trouba. They have a lot of big names on their team. You look at a team like Colorado, who won it a couple of years ago. They you know, have like Nathan MacKinnon. You know, they have Cale Makar. But they had no names in goal. Like, you know, they have some other, like Andrei Nechushkin. They have some other players. Like, they had players that were there. The point I'm trying to make is that you're only a contender by how well you play. And what I mean by that is that right now, people should not look at this and say, oh, the Flyers have a chance to win the Stanley Cup this year. Okay, take a step back. If you get into a 7-game series against the Rangers, the Devils, the Penguins, you know, Toronto. Like, I hate to say Toronto, but because Toronto has
The talent is there.
They have the offense. Teams have offensive ability where they have players that can execute important situations.
Here's my counter to that, and I think you might be even going to this. They just held what Torts called the best team in the NHL in Dallas to one shot on goal in the first, I think, 26 minutes of play. That is utterly insane to like the fact that I said that out loud. One shot on net in 26 minutes.
Correct.
This is a defense.
They shut out Winnipeg.
This is a defense. Best team in the league. This is a defense first team because of Torts.
Agreed.
It can get weird in the playoffs.
Agreed.
Would I bet on the team on DraftKings that they would win the Stanley Cup? I don't even know what their odds are right now. I should look that up. No. Would I bet that they would beat, because right now they're in second place, so they would play Carolina, I believe. Would I bet that they would beat Carolina in a 7-game series? You bet your ass I would. I think they can beat a Carolina, not handedly, but pretty sustainably.
It would probably take 7 games to do it.
Yeah, that's
what I mean.
It'd probably
take 7 games. It probably would. Like, you know, like I'm talking about when you're talking about a deep playoff run. Now, listen, the way the East is shaking out, like you don't know, like stranger things have happened, but I don't think that this team is at a point where basically it comes off of being a dead last team last year and going straight to the final. I think that this team has a trajectory that it needs to get to, kind of like that what Chicago did in the late 2000s, because yes, although they had Kane and Taves, you know, they are looking to get better, and not just that too. But for instance, if you're looking at the standings here, let's look at the wild cards. The Flyers are solid in second. You have Detroit in the first wild card. You have Tampa in the second wild card. You have Pittsburgh on their tails too. Pittsburgh's falling back a little bit. They're 8 points behind the Flyers. They're at 48 points.
Do you call it them falling back or the? I mean, we were talking about the Flyers are just winning. They're clearing hurdles. Like the Flyers are just putting padding between these. We talked about it because like we talked about how they were at like a 70 as high as a 77% chance. Then it dipped to about 60. Now they're flirting around 70% chance of making the playoffs again. But it's because of all the tightness.
Yeah, but I'm not even talking about that. Like for instance, like okay, Washington, they're third in the wild card of 50 points, and they have a minus 21 goal differential. Pittsburgh.
We're over an hour in. The children are let loose into this podcast.
Hey, quiet, Wyatt. My God. Anyway, so
after you have an hour, it's all hell lets loose on this podcast.
So you have Washington at 50 points, and you have with a minus 21 goal differential, and you have Pittsburgh at plus 16 with 48 points. So that's what I'm saying is like Pittsburgh, and it's because they have a rough start, but at the same time, there's no reason that Pittsburgh should be behind Washington with that goal differential. So the issue that I'm seeing is that, yeah, teams are going to start turning the corner here a little bit and getting a little tighter and things like that. But the Flyers, it's wide open. It's wide open for the Flyers in the East because you're going to have maybe Detroit make the playoffs for the first time in a few years here. You have Tampa on the fringe looking outside in, you know, and then you have, of course, the Atlantic Division, which is, you know, Boston, Florida, and Toronto, of course. So, but the Flyers have more points than Toronto and they have, you know, the most stupid payroll in the entire league. I'm just saying is like, I'm not trying to contradict my point. You have to see where this team is at the end of this year. And then you make your adjustments about what you're going from here. Okay. They're not going to go all in and try to be like, okay, we can go win a Stanley Cup next year. Okay. What pieces do we need to do now? Like, we don't want to hurt ourselves getting into a playoff spot, but what's more valuable to us? Trading Sean Walker because we're not going to get anything for him in the offseason because he's a free agent and going to want too much money, and we get an asset back for him and have somebody step into his role full-time, how detrimental is that going to be to the team? A guy like Mark Stahl, who behind the scenes, I'm telling you, has been probably a really important part for this team, for this young defense. Mm-hmm. And also, you have to think of Nick Seeler. Like, Seeler, I know they like him. They know they probably want to sign him to another contract, you know, to long-term because he's playing very well.
Yeah, I saw reports that said that they want to keep him around too.
Right, but is he going to fetch you good value on the market? Yeah. And that's what the Flyers have to balance right now.
I'm sure they have a nice list of players that like we're moving them no matter what. Like whatever we can get, fifth round pick, doesn't matter. We're getting rid of them. They have the fringe guys that's like, unless we're blown away by this, we're keeping them. Which are like the guys that are tenured, the Kootzes of the world, even the Hearts, right? Because he's a RFA. And then there's the guys that are like, we want to sign them, but if we get an offer that blows us away again in that scenario, yeah, we're going to move on from them because we can probably build something. It's all about the risk of what you want to take in this trade deadline. And the Flyers have assets to be moved if they so choose to move them, and I think every Flyers fan should be fine with that, despite their feelings on the players. And here's my hot take, not hot take, but I think Torts is a Sam Ersson guy more than a Carter Hart guy, like almost significantly more into Ersson.
I think that.
And I don't think that's a wrong thing. I think Hart's a really good player.
No, I agree with you. And I think from a standing like this is that so Carter's had some things this year. Battled some illnesses, a little bit of injury. Like, you know, he's battled some of that stuff. Sam has been pretty solid after since the second game of the season. He's been getting much better and much better and much better. I mean, you know, he's played in 20 games, started 19 of them, and Carter Hart, you know, for this year has played in 25 games and started 24. So part of that's due to injury and stuff. That's why Ersson's got a little more starts, and they're going to ride Carter Hart as much as they can. But now you have this two-headed monster. And you really both have them under control. Like, you know, you don't have to fully make a decision right now. But I think the thing is that there's two parts of it. They like the way Ersson plays. He likes the confidence that Ersson has. But again, this is part of development because you need Ersin to play in order to see what he is. Am I sold on Sam Ersin? No, I'm not sold on Sam Ersin. Again, though, I'm a little bit biased because I also believe that because you can't look at a guy who's played such a smaller sample size in the NHL this year. Yes, he's played 20 games. Okay. Last year he went 10-6-3 with the Flyers. This year he's played in 20 games so far. I need to see what he does, not over the course of a full season, but I need to see what he does in the next season as well before I'm giving him the reins.
Here's my question just for the fun of it. And we can wrap on this because we're getting long. It's game 7, Flyers versus Carolina.
Don't even ask. Yeah, you know my answer. You know my answer.
Can we say it at the same time? Because I do think we were at the same one.
Okay.
One, two, three. Carter Hart.
Yep. You're going Carter Hart. He's got the playoff experience. I'm sorry. He's got the experience. He's a veteran at this point.
Despite my feelings and thoughts that Torts does favor Ersin right now, especially because, and it's all speculation. I'm not like, there's no, we're just reading the room here because Torts gives Ersin the start against what he calls the best team in the league. Was it scheduled? Whatever. What is presented to me when he calls the team that they just beat 5-1 with their seemingly backup goalie and Sam Ersin playing that game, I tend to think that Torts favors that guy. But like you said, playoffs are very differently. I would not be shocked if in a 7-game series, 3 wins for Carter Hart and 3 losses for Sam Ersin. If like, obviously there's not going to be a back and forth like that, but like in this, like, would not be shocked by that kind of scenario where Carter just takes
Boston did last year. Look what happened to Boston. Yeah. That's what happened to Boston last year. They went to Jeremy Swayman in game 7 and they shouldn't have done that. And they lost.
Yeah.
They lost.
You don't put any fear in that the playoff experience that Carter has is just in the bubble in 2020.
No, I don't, because I think he's had a wealth of games and being able to handle everything as far as what to expect. I think he's seen a lot more, and that's the experience you talk about when you're in the playoffs. Now, listen, I don't have an issue with this because I've seen this work in the past. It's a lot, just from my perspective, it's a lot simpler to go to a younger guy first and then to a veteran in a playoff situation. Meaning that if you're going to give Sam Ersin the shot and think he's earned it, and all of a sudden you find yourself in an 0-2 hole and we got to make a change here, guess where they're changing? They're not changing too much in the line. I'm changing the goaltender.
Yep.
They're changing the goaltender as that R just lights up behind my head because I'm talking.
That was so amazingly timed.
Yeah, right? You know, as the R comes up because I'm Hoekstradamus. So the what happens here is that you give it to Ersin, and if you go back and look in history, there's a lot of situations where that has worked.
Yep.
When you go to the veteran secondly, it had worked with Braden Holtby when the Capitals won the Stanley Cup in 2018. It worked with Cam Ward back in 2005. There's been other situations too where you change to another goaltender or the veteran at I think it was 2000 and I have to think about the top of my head. But I have seen situations where you have a younger guy who's not quite there yet and not quite getting done. You switch to the veteran, all of a sudden they go on a tear. And I think even look at Tim Thomas in 2011. Duke Rask was that guy who went up being a backup by the time playoffs were around, and next thing you know, you're running with it. It's that veteran presence is crucial, and I think that the team is going to lean into that because at the same time, you're also having Ersin push Carter Hart. So it's all good, and it's speculation. But at the same time, I think the biggest piece that people aren't seeing out of this is that the team is still consistent no matter who you have in goal. So you can't put the goaltender just under the microscope. It's the most important position. But teams have won with less. Vegas won with Aiden Hill. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, no disrespect to Darcy Kemper, but he won a Stanley Cup with Colorado on a stacked team. Sometimes if you have a good team game, you can get away with average goaltending, and that's what it is. You know what? I had to, just before we go, just to talk about what he was talking about there. You know, a lot of people don't realize that that series was tumultuous. Like, that was a, you know, and he's right. Like, to this day, John Van Beesbrouck is still the playoff, the leader in playoff stats for a goaltender in Philadelphia. And he played six games here.
Yep.
But the point is like, they had that game two wrapped, and then Steve Thomas scored. And then it was Matt Sundin who got the goal like 30 seconds later, and they went from winning 1-0 to losing 2-1. And it was brutal. Yeah, and they just never got the wraps back on. I'll never forget game six in that series. It was Sergei Bereson. It was a 0-0 game with a minute to go in the third period. John LeClair and Darcy Tucker get into it. LeClair gets called for a penalty. Bereson scores on a power play with a minute left. Boom, Flyer season over. Like, it was like that.
Like that.
So, and I can get it from his perspective why he would still think of that. Like, man, like that one goal. That one bad goal that you just like, oh, I should have had that one. Like, that can deflate your team. So when I talk about things as a goalie and saying that's how it can deflate your team, you just heard it from a pro's mouth. Like, that happens. You had to take that stuff into consideration when you see momentum of a team.
Yeah.
So great insight on it. I love it.
Just need to say that. So thank you as always for listening, and we will catch you next time. Who knows what the winning streak will be for the Flyers by then, but let's keep enjoying it. It's all we can do. Until next time, catch you later.